Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, March 27th. I'm Kelly Lincoln, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt Soups extend cannabis tax payment deadline. Mendocino County District Attorney faces scrutiny over spending. And Lauren Schmidt gives Dr. Little Miss Hot Mess voice after national dress down. Stay tuned. News on these stories and more coming right up. Against a backdrop of national chaos, Congressman Jared Huffman is holding a live town hall Sunday, March 30th, from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Adorney Center in Eureka. In the most recent alarming event, yesterday, a Turkish woman named Rumeyza Ozturk was arrested off the streets near Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts, by six people later identified as immigration officers. They were wearing all black clothes with face masks. They placed her into an unmarked vehicle and took her away. The incident was captured in security camera video. No warrant was shown to her. According to her attorney, Ozturk has a valid visa to study in the United States and was not issued a letter or notice to appear on charges before her apprehension. Last night, a U.S. district judge issued emergency orders to the U.S. immigration officials for her to remain in Massachusetts unless the department gave 48 hours notice to her attorney. Disregarding the judicial order, they moved her without notice to a prison in Louisiana. Her crime appears to be a letter to the editor she wrote last year in support of pro-Palestinian protesters at her school, Tufts University. Huffman's press release states that at his town hall on Sunday, he will share his plans as ranking member of the House Committee on National Resources, discuss the new Trump administration, and take questions from participants. Those who want to attend in person must RSVP through his congressional website by tomorrow, Friday the 28th at 5 p.m., and guests will be admitted into the Adorney Center first come, first serve, as space allows. If you cannot make it to Eureka on Sunday, you can also listen to the town hall via Access Humboldt online or on TV. In local current events, Dave Taylor, a longtime Whale Gulch resident in his early 80s, was reported missing to the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office in early February after he was last seen at the Whitethorn Post Office. Then Tuesday, a person was found deceased in a single car accident near Bryceland. Mendocino County Sheriff's Department Captain Quincy Cromer confirms these are the same person.
So I'll give you a little rundown of the history of this investigation. So on February 18th of 2025, just around 11 a.m., the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office was informed of a possible missing person in the Whitethorn, California area. And for those listeners you have that might not be familiar with us, for Mendocino County, that's one of the most remote areas that we patrol and have in our jurisdiction. So we actually have to travel into Humboldt County and head west at Redway and go back into Mendocino County, like on our way to Shelter Cove. So this is a very remote area. The missing person from this investigation was identified as an 84-year-old male, David Taylor, who was last seen on February 6th. And Taylor was known to reside at a residence in the 77,000 block of Usall Road there in Whitethorn. So the sheriff's office learned that Taylor was transported to a hospital in Humboldt County on February 5th and later brought back to Whitethorn on February 6th of 2025. And Taylor was last seen in his vehicle at the Whitethorn Post Office there on February 6th. So the Sheriff's Office deputies took a report for Taylor being reported as missing and coordinated with multiple first responder organizations to assist in searching for Taylor. I know a lot of local residents and family and friends also searched for him because he was pretty well known in that area. So search efforts were conducted by numerous local fire agencies, the Southern Humboldt Technical Rescue Team, California Highway Patrol, Humboldt County Sheriff, Mendocino County Sheriff, and Mendocino County SAR for search and rescue. So after multiple search deployments and efforts, no clues or evidence whatsoever were located regarding Taylor's possible whereabouts. So you fast forward to March 25th, which would have been Tuesday of this week, a deceased male subject was found in an overturned vehicle in an apparent traffic collision in Humboldt County on Beaver Slide Lane in Bryceland, California. An autopsy for that decedent was completed by the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, and during the autopsy, the decedent was positively identified as David Taylor, who was previously reported as missing to us at the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office. From the autopsy, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office determined that Taylor had died within minutes of the motor vehicle collision of a cervical spine fracture. And we would just like to express our gratitude, as would the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, for all of the agencies and their personnel for their efforts and assistance in searching for Taylor on this case.
Yeah, and our sympathy out there to Whale Gulch. He was well-loved.
Yeah, absolutely. And the friends and family, again, our deepest condolences to everyone that knew Mr. Taylor and everybody that searched for him. I know that this definitely struck that community. It's a very small community, but it's a very tight-knit community. So please, you know, portray our condolences and thoughts with all the family and friends.
In Humboldt County, today, Thursday, March 27th, Humboldt County Drug Task Force agents executed search warrants at two locations in Eureka, one on C Avenue and another on 8th Street. The addresses are related to Gabriel Zachariah Giroux, age 49, suspected of selling large quantities of fentanyl. Agents seized 1.5 pounds of fentanyl during the searches. However, the suspect was not located. The task force says they will be requesting an arrest warrant for him on charges including possessions of narcotics for sale, operating a drug house, and elder abuse. Humboldt County cannabis farmers who have Measure S excise tax debts will have another 9 months to pay them. Daniel Mintz reports.
Recognizing the hardships of cannabis farming in Humboldt County, a majority of the Board of Supervisors has voted to extend a Measure S tax debt payment deadline by 9 months. Numerous cannabis farmers were at the March 25th supervisors meeting to talk about their experiences in a harsh cannabis market. On the agenda was a staff recommendation to extend a March 31st deadline for full payments of Measure S excise tax debts by 6 months. Farmers who missed a March 31st, 2024 deadline to enter into back tax payment plans have had their permits suspended, and supervisors are in the process of revoking their permits. 36 have been revoked so far, and at the meeting, Planning Director John Ford said of a total of 1,651 active county permits, 210 are held by those who have not entered into tax debt payment plans. There are 423 cannabis producers who are in payment plans. Ford added that 76% of active permit holders have paid off their Measure S debts. During a public comment period, farmers who are struggling to meet a variety of expenses told supervisors of the precarious nature of cannabis farming, including Nick Glass, owner of Humco Traditions.
I'm under some serious economic conditions now because of my road slide. I live out on the 36, and for the last 2.5 months, I've not been able to have anyone come up to my farm to get anything due to, you know, the road closures, and it's looking like that's going to continue now for months. So I'm not even sure, you know, how I'm going to continue this year if I can't get anyone to come up to my farm to pick my product up. So with that, you know, I've been trying to get, I'm a small farm under 10,000 square feet. Me and my wife operate it. And we would like to maybe, you know, have some leniency on a micro business license. You know, Santa Cruz and Mendocino both have put this into action where if you're owner operator and you live there and grow under 10,000 square feet, you automatically get a micro business license. That way I could bring my product to town and have relationships with these dispensaries.
The micro business permit idea got some support among supervisors and will be pursued. Several cannabis farmers said distributors haven't followed through on payments. Crystal Ortiz said it's happened to her and it compounded other losses.
In 2018, due to conditions around the newly licensed scheme, we sold all our crop to an extraction facility in Adelanto. And despite having long-standing dispensary relationships and a good price for trim pounds at the time, we chose to operate completely within the parameters of our compliance agreement and took the lower price for a guaranteed sale that could be processed off of the farm as we had agreed upon. They paid us a deposit, picked the product up, and 60 days later, when the terms were due, they showed up with $13,000 on a $350,000 bill. For the first time in my adult life, I had no backup plan, no job, and no ability to pay my mortgage. I scrambled, I sold whatever I could, and tried to keep a roof over my family's head. I started moving shelves around in a cycle that has never stopped since. I lost my health insurance in April, and in June, my daughter was in a terrible car accident, and we were straddled with another $110,000 in debt. We were not bad at business. We were consistently forced to make decisions that are not good for business.
Saying, quote, "My heart is pounding in my chest," Natalyn DeLapp of the Humboldt County Growers Alliance implored supervisors to heed what farmers were telling them. She described Measure S as a broken tax that needs to be brought back to voters in a form more suited to the current situation. Supervisors discussed the circumstances and their options at length with Board Chair and Southern Humboldt Supervisor Michelle Bushnell, a cannabis permit holder herself, being the most empathetic. She said her Garberville-based business, The Bootleg, is failing, and Soham is a different place now.
It is heartbreaking for me. I also see Southern Humboldt, that was very dependent on cannabis, become, it was such a thriving community, to nothing. It's hard for me. I'm born and raised there and have seen lots of transitions down in Southern Humboldt, but this transition, how devastated the community is, I've never seen. And I've been there 54 years, and I've seen it go through cattle and timber and fishing, and every time has been able to bounce back some and not lose over 50% of its businesses. Willow Creek, I know, is the same. It is just really heartbreaking for me. And I know that people are, you know, they're trying their last bit effort to salvage what they've known their whole life and to continue forward. And you know, farming for a lot of folks is their dream. It's their lifelong dream. And it's who they are. And I've heard that today. I've also heard it in my community over the last 5 years that I've been a supervisor.
Following up on a proposal by Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, Bushnell made a motion to extend the debt payment deadline to December 31st, with the 210 permit holders who haven't entered into payment plans given until April 4th to do so. Bushnell described the deadlines as final. The motion passed with a 4-1 vote. Supervisor Steve Madrone voted no, having earlier explained that being too lenient isn't fair to those who've paid their taxes. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino County, KZYX News' Elise Cox brings us a story about the long-embattled Mendocino County District Attorney.
David Eister, the Mendocino County District Attorney who filed charges against Cubison, is under public scrutiny for questionable use of public funds. KZYX News interviewed independent reporter Mike Janella about a public records request he made regarding Eister's request for reimbursement for a staff banquet held in February. The records revealed Eister asked the county to reimburse his department $3,600 for a banquet held February 20th at the Broiler Steakhouse in Redwood Valley. 72 people attended, including employees of the district attorney's office, their spouses, significant others, and some other guests. Janella wonders if the banquet could violate Mendocino County Policy 1. This is the county's purchasing, leasing, and contracting policy. It specifically states that departments are not authorized to pay for banquets or award ceremonies. In requesting reimbursement, Eister categorized the banquet as a staff workshop and continuing education. The agenda for the workshop included longevity recognition to employees, including 25-year office veteran Sherry Arrington and Alex Johnston, a 10-year member of the staff. Janella said he made the records request in response to a tip.
I heard that, in fact, in February, the DA had held another one of these dinners. So I made the request under the Public Records Act to see, did he in fact have it, when and how it was paid? And then I called a few of my remaining courthouse sources who confirmed he was still having spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends as guests, et cetera. So it became clear between the Public Records Act information and what people who had actually witnessed this event, that he was continuing to do the same thing that he has always done with this, despite the 18-month saga of prosecuting the auditor who questioned him about it.
When Janella looked to see who had signed off on the request, he discovered something unusual.
I discovered, and I was surprised by this, I discovered that there was a line on the claim that said, pre-approved by Darcy Antle, the CEO of Mendocino County. And as I think we all understand, Ms. Antle was a prime prosecution witness in the Cuppas and preliminary hearing. So it was not only a pre-approved, it was even pre-approved. It was paid before the event actually happened.
It was hard not to make the connection between the ongoing preliminary hearing on the criminal charges that David Oyster had filed against Shamis Cubison.
You know, I guess we could speculate, but the event was on February 20th. Ms. Cubison was cleared of the criminal charge on February 25th. It just makes you wonder, well, were they getting their ducks in order before what they feared could happen? So anyway, it was a very odd that she would a controversial dinner.
Janella said it's not so much the amount of money that may have been misspent. It's questionable. It's the message the district attorney appeared to have wanted to send.
You know, the $3,600 gets anyone's attention and says for a one-night deal. But it's not the amount of money so much, because if you split it off into who was entitled to be there and who wasn't, you know, we're now down into the hundreds of dollars. But it's the fact that, well, I'll say that it seems like the district attorney was thumbing his nose at everybody by continuing a dinner that had been questioned and challenged. And ultimately led to the dropping of criminal charges against the accused auditor, and he just carried on.
Oyster did not respond to a request for comment from Mike Janella or from KZYX News.
In state news, efforts to get insurance rates down to prevent a collapse in California's real estate market and overall economy are moving forward in the legislature, where two bills that seek to recover costs for climate-linked disasters, including the Los Angeles fires, from oil and gas companies have been introduced. Susan Potter reports.
Insurance rates are rising fast in California because of fires and floods linked to climate change, and now two new bills in Sacramento seek to make oil and gas companies pay. The Affordable Insurance and Climate Recovery Act would create legal pathways for homeowners, insurance companies, and the state insurance plan to sue and recover losses from oil and gas companies. Melissa Romero with California Environmental Voters says the companies misled lawmakers and the public.
The one group that hasn't paid their fair share in all of this is oil and gas companies. They knew since the 70s, the 80s, that their products were creating runaway climate change. They hid the science, they did nothing about it, and they continued to push an agenda that stymied a lot of efforts to switch over to clean energy.
The Western States Petroleum Association called the bills a way for politicians to capitalize on tragedy. The California Independent Petroleum Association has said the real culprits for the fires are arsonists, environmental lawsuits that prevent forest management, and cuts to firefighting budgets. Romero also supports the Polluters Pay Superfund bill, which would charge fossil fuel companies according to their role in climate change and invest in climate-resilient communities.
It requires the California Environmental Protection Agency to do a report about the actual cost, both looking backwards and forwards, that climate change has caused California in terms of our infrastructure and disaster response.
Proponents of the bills complained that insurance ratepayers and taxpayers are hard hit by climate disasters. The state's FAIR plan, the insurer of last resort, has assessed insurers and ratepayers $1 billion for LA wildfire claims so far. Meanwhile, State Farm is likely to get regulators' permission to raise homeowners' insurance rates by 22% after a hearing on April 8th. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A drag queen who goes by the name Dr. Little Miss Hot Mess was targeted in her absence yesterday morning by Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene during the Wednesday, March 26th congressional hearing on public broadcast funding. KMed's Lauren Schmidt spoke with Little Miss Hot Mess about that controversy, the joy of drag, and what it means to keep showing up in the face of hatred.
Thank you so much for joining us in what I believe is your first public interview since yesterday's congressional hearing. Can you share an overview of what occurred yesterday in your own words?
I woke up to a bunch of texts and messages across social media of friends alerting me to the fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene had held up this honestly beautiful headshot of myself in this hearing while she was attacking PBS and NPR and other public media. She certainly did not get my permission. She also showed a video of me that I had created as part of a performance for a series on a local PBS affiliate. She did not get permission to show that either. And, you know, unfortunately, I was not surprised. Folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene and her colleagues in the Republican Party have frequently attacked me, have attacked other members of Drag Story Hour, of drag and LGBTQ communities more broadly. So while it's deeply disappointing to have to listen to her disingenuous and hate and disinformation, at the end of the day, I'm sadly not surprised.
Drag Queen Story Hour has been both celebrated and vilified. What do critics fundamentally misunderstand about the program, its purpose, and maybe even drag in general?
I think so many of our critics see drag as inherently about adult notions of sexuality and gender, when really drag is an art form, it's a practice of play, it's a way of activating our imaginations and letting our creativity out and kind of having fun in a way that helps us think critically about the world and remake it into the kind of world that we want it to be. And I just think more people should be celebrating anyone who's reading to children, anyone who's educating children in, you know, thoughtful, diverse sorts of ways. And it's just really such a shame that they can't see the value in our program. And, you know, at the end of the day, I always say, if they don't like it, they don't have to come. If they don't like, you know, a drag queen on their TVs, they can change the channel. It's really as simple as that. But to try to ruin everyone's fun, to literally defund not only these programs, but also major public institutions like public media, like, you know, public libraries, public education, so many of our fundamental institutions that they're trying to tear down now. It's really just shows that they have an even deeper agenda, which is to make life harder and much less joyful for all of us.
Representative Greene labeled you and other drag performers as child predators. What do you think these kind of attacks reveal about the broader political agenda against queer and trans representation?
I really have no words for it. You know, the thought that any of us are out here to harm children rather than to, you know, celebrate them, educate them, you know, foster their imagination and creativity is honestly shameful and disgusting on her part. In many ways, and unfortunately, what we're seeing is just a recycling of the same tired old playbook by the right. It's taken on new forms, it's taken on new flavors. They've, in many ways, you know, mainstream Republican politicians have aligned themselves with even further and further right forces, including white supremacists, literal neo-Nazis, you know, many other really dangerous fundamentalists that have really come into the center of the Republican Party. And, you know, I think in many ways it's again, this tired old homophobia and transphobia. It's hatred towards LGBTQ people and a belief that, you know, straight white cis men are superior to everyone else. I think it is also part of this desire to defund and literally tear apart the structures of public institutions that benefit so many people, and especially, you know, lower income working class people in this country. And I also think it's a broader attack on just a general sense of imagination and critical thinking. You know, I think that they want us to obey, they want us to feel scared so that we feel compelled to. And this is the kind of rising authoritarianism that we're seeing rising very quickly in this country right now in this second Trump presidency. And it's very scary. And so I do like to say, you know, while I don't think that attacks on drag performers are necessarily the most pressing issue in the country right now, I also don't think they're a complete distraction either, because I think that they really, it's all part of the same playbook. And it's all part of kind of, again, making us afraid, weakening us and making us fear each other.
While the attacks against the queer community are certainly not new, there's been an unprecedented effort to erase trans identity, like the Stonewall Memorial, where the Park Service deleted the word transgender on the Stonewall website, despite the fact that trans women led that movement. And I also want to note, you are a professor and hold a PhD from NYU. And now to see you being targeted in a congressional hearing that's supposed to be about institutions like public media, institutions that bring us the news, do you see a connection there?
Yes. I mean, it's certainly part of their playbook to go after not only communities that are minoritized and marginalized, but also to go after, you know, groups of people that promote, again, a certain level of critical thinking, of critique, of government structures, of various forms of creativity. You know, in many other times and places where, you know, various forms of fascism have taken hold, they do target educators, intellectuals, artists, all sorts of cultural workers, as well as, you know, queer and trans people and other marginalized groups. And so, yeah, I think it's no surprise, unfortunately, that folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene are coming after me and others. What I think is a little bit funny in this case is, you know, I don't think she realized who she is messing with. I always love to quote the great Sylvia Rivera, who said, "Hell hath no fury like a drag queen scorned." And I'll just say, I'm feeling pretty scorned right now and ready to step into the ring.
We appreciate you stepping into the ring to speak to us today. And my final question is, at a time when drag is under increased political scrutiny, what do you want families, educators, youth, and policymakers to understand about the value of drag as a form of self-expression and community care?
Drag, again, as an art form, it is about, like you said, self-expression. It's about finding your inner voice. It's about, you know, finding that inner light inside of you and letting it shine to a broader world. Drag performers, we are loud. We know how to, you know, organize crowds, make people happy, make people listen to us. We've been, you know, part of a lot of major social movements in the LGBT community and beyond. So if they think we're going anywhere, they have another thing coming.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you to our reporters Daniel Mintz, Suzanne Potter, and Lauren Schmidt. KMUD News is online. You can find us at kmud.org. And our stories are now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcast and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. If you have any questions or suggestions, give us a call at 707-923-9222. 2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Kelly Lincoln.